From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And our first guest this morning is Jennifer Ackerman, science and nature writer and author of the book, What an Owl Knows, the new science of the world's most enigmatic bird, now available in paperback.
That's right. In many societies, owls are often a symbol of wisdom, knowledge, and foresight. Yet in others, they're seen as evil and a bad omen. Some 260 species of owls exist today, and they reside on every continent except Antarctica.
And despite their numbers and our fascination, owls are difficult to find and study because they are cryptic, camouflage, and most active at night. So scientists have only recently begun to understand the complex nature of these extraordinary birds, and Jennifer Ackerman will discuss this, all of this, in her new book, What an Owl Knows. That's in the first part of the show.
Then in the second part of the show, we'll turn our attention to the sea, specifically saltwater intrusion into freshwater systems, and how climate change and overconsumption are allowing more and more saltwater to migrate into surface and groundwater systems.
Dr. Holly Michael, who's a professor of earth sciences and civil and environmental engineering, will join us to explain this phenomenon, its impacts to ecosystems, and what we can do to slow or even reverse its movement. That's in the second part of the show.
All that, and if we have time, some news about the changing sources of electricity around the U.S. 10 years ago, it was primarily coal. Now that fossil fuel is nearly gone. Well, plus or minus, we'll give you some details on that. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And we're going to start off the show this morning with author Jennifer Ackerman. She is a science and nature writer who has just penned a book. Well, penned it last year, right, and it just came out in paperback. It's called What an Owl Knows, the new science of the world's most enigmatic bird. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So I want to start off first. We always like to get a little bit of knowledge about the person behind the book. So tell us, Jennifer, a little bit about how you got into nature and science writing, and particularly into this topic.
So I've been a bird watcher since I was a child, and I went bird watching with my father on the C&O Canal in Washington, D.C., And that was the beginning, really, of a lifelong love of birds. It's always been my goal to be a kind of a translator between complicated science and the layperson. So what I really love to do is to explain what scientists do, to go out in the field with them, and then to write up a story, to put the material in a narrative that's very compelling to read. So I've written about all kinds of subjects, genetics and human biology, ocean biology, lots of different topics. But I came to birds about 10 years ago with a book called The Genius of Birds, and that's about bird intelligence. And from there, I went on to write The Bird Way, and then What an Owl Knows. So I'm kind of deep in the groove of birds now, and I love it. I'm probably here for good.
Well, let's start to talk about this bird of prey. And I think some of the things that set an owl apart, I know that there are many different species, and we're going to get into the sizing and the different communication sounds that they do. But first, I want to talk about one of the things that strikes me most about owls is the uniqueness of their eyes. And a lot of birds obviously don't have those forward-facing eyes. So can you tell us a little bit about the genius to their eyes?
Yes, it's such a good point. Owls in general have eyes that are just huge for their body size. So I like to tell people that if my eyes were in similar proportion to my body as an owl's eyes are to its body, well, my eyes would be about the size of an orange and they'd weigh almost 4 pounds. Hmm. So they're really big eyes. And as you point out, they're forward facing, which is very unusual in the bird world. Usually birds have their eyes on the side of their heads to better perceive predators. But owls have their eyes locked in a forward-facing gaze, and that helps them to zero in on moving prey. And the really wonderful thing about owl eyes is that they're super sensitive to light, so that owls can see in very, very dim light. For instance, an owl's pupils can swell to almost the entire size of the eye, and that lets in, you know, about twice as much light as human pupils do. And they also have a super abundance of those light collecting cells called rods. And that gives them about 100 times the light sensitivity of, you know, say a pigeon.
Wow.
So obviously all this is designed for them to see at night compared to other creatures.
That's correct. That's, you know, it's a huge advantage in their hunting. But the real owl superpower in terms of nighttime hunting is their hearing. Mm. They can actually detect prey without the use of their eyes at all, just by hearing alone.
Yeah, and is that a function of their facial design too? That the way they have a kind of a plate or almost like a dish type of shape to their face?
Yes. So owls that hunt by ear, I think of particularly like barn owls or great gray owls, they have these heads that are really designed for listening. So just as you say, they have a kind of flat facial disc, and it almost acts like this big external ear. It's kind of like a feathered satellite dish, and it collects sound and channels it toward the ears, which are just holes in the side of the head of an owl. And the equipment inside those ears are really exquisitely sensitive to sound.
And they're not, for lack of a better way to put this, like the ears aren't exactly lined up. They are kind of differently proportioned.
Offset?
Yeah.
Yes, they are. They're asymmetrical, at least in some species. For instance, great gray owls or boreal owls, their ears are asymmetrically placed on their heads, one higher than the other. And that actually gives them a remarkable ability to precisely locate the source of even the faintest noise in three-dimensional space. Mm. And then they have this very long, what's called a cochlea, which is the hearing organ in the brain, and it's packed with hair cells, the hearing cells of the brain, and that gives barn owls, other owls, a sense of hearing that's really almost unequaled in the animal world.
Well, now we've talked about the eyes and the ears. Now I want to get to communication sounds, and they are different by species, and they communicate differently. Can you kind of break that down for us?
Yes, you know, you think of, well, first of all, the hoot of an owl is really one of the few bird calls that most people know. Mm-hmm. Scientists have really discovered that there are lots of different kinds of hoots in the owl world. In fact, owls have really elaborate vocal repertoires, and though their vocalizations are teeming with meaning. So owls have greeting hoots, they have territorial hoots, they have emphatic hoots, and they don't just hoot, they also kind of chitter and squawk and squeal, and all these different calls communicate really specific information about the owl itself, about its sex, its size, its weight, its individual identity, and even its state of mind.
So when you say its sex, what differs there, I guess?
Well, it depends on the species, but males and females definitely do have different kinds of calls. And also the hooting calls, territorial calls of individual owls vary from one individual to the next. So they're so individual that they're almost like fingerprints. And the owls actually use these individual nature of their vocalizations to tell mates and allies and family members, rivals. They can tell them each other apart by their vocalizations alone. And it turns out so can scientists. So they can actually identify individual owls by their vocalizations, and it allows them to count the owls better, and it also allows them to keep track of their social lives in a very interesting way. They can sort of listen in on who's mating with whom, for instance.
And they're kind of vocal acrobats, correct? They can imitate sounds.
They certainly do have a range of vocalizations. And, you know, they're used in very specific contexts for very specific purposes. So, for instance, they have a, you know, a certain kind of mating call, and then they'll have a little call that's kind of about keeping contact with a mate. So a real range of purposes for their vocalizations.
I thought I'd heard that they could imitate rattlesnakes.
Oh, well, that is true. You're quite right. There is one species, the chicks can imitate the rattle of a rattlesnake. Now, this is a burrowing owl, and when burrowing owl chicks are threatened by a raccoon or a fox or a skunk or something, their nests are in the ground, mm-hmm. and so that these predators are really a threat to them. But these little baby birds will hiss just like the kind of rattle of a rattlesnake, and it puts off the predators. And also sometimes the researchers who are reaching their hand into a burrow to pick up a chick to band it or something, they'll hear this rattle and they'll think, oh my gosh, is it a snake? It's very effective mimicry.
Yeah, this is really interesting because most bird species have a call or a song or so that's just kind of a single type of call or sound that they communicate of some sort with each other. But this sounds like you're saying that with these birds can have the capacity to develop their own unique brand call. Is that rare in bird species? And how is that? Is that something that's a learned behavior? I'm trying to get my head around this ability to communicate.
It's a very good question. And many birds have highly distinctive vocalizations, vocal calls. Especially birds that live in social groups. I think of parrots, for instance. They have very individual contact calls, and it's how they keep track of each other. So this is not unique to owls, but owls, unlike other birds, like songbirds, for instance, owls don't learn their vocalizations over time. Mm-hmm. They're actually born with them. They have, they're hardwired. Many songbirds learn their songs over time, and they learn them from a tutor, but this is not true of owls.
Yes, we are speaking with Jennifer Ackerman, who is a science and nature writer and author of the book, What an Owl Knows. And you are breaking down a lot of interesting facts about these very unique individual birds of prey. But one of the things that I'm interested in also is are there some mating rituals? Are there unique rituals to owls that draw another mate?
Yes, one of my favorites is the short-eared owl, which at sunset, the male does what's called a sky dance, and he goes way up in the sky. Female's on the ground and she's watching him. The male goes way up in the sky and he starts to drop suddenly, and he kind of claps his wings beneath him. It's almost like he's applauding his own performance, but it's a very startling move, and the female is down on the ground and she's sort of judging his performance and deciding whether she's going to mate with him. It's quite a remarkable thing to see, and it occurs, as I said, just at sunset. It's very beautiful.
Well, along those same lines, their wings seem to be designed to produce little to no noise, which provides extreme benefits during hunts.
That's right. Their wings and feathers, they have very unique features that hush their flight, so they can actually hear their prey and also approach it very quietly without alerting it. And in fact, the feathers and wings of owls are so brilliant at quieting sound that engineers and designers have actually used them to model noise-reducing structures in all kinds of things, like wind turbine blades, you know, airplanes, even Japan's bullet trains.
Huh.
Oh, I was just there. We're doing those bullet trains.
Did you know?
Little did
that
I know
that the feathers that
owls
train.
Yeah, and what are some of the things about the feathers that mute that sound?
Yes. Well, first of all, I'll say that most birds make noise when they fly for two main reasons. You know, the air flowing over their wing surface produces kind of turbulence, air eddies that make noise. And also, their feathers make a lot of noise when they rub together, so they kind of rustle and whoosh and rasp. Now, owl wings have these really marvelous features that hush these sounds. They have what's called a comb. It's a row of fine hair-like bristles that extend forward on the leading edge of the wing where it meets the oncoming air. So when the airflow hits that comb, those little serrations, they break up the turbulence, and that effectively suppresses that kind of any swoosh sound that the bird would make in flight. And then there's a soft layer of velvet. It's kind of plush fibers that coat the feathers in the whole wing. And that soft layer of velvety, plushy fibers silences any kind of those rubbing, rasping together noises that feathers might make otherwise.
I want to turn to kind of the cultural aspects and views of owls, because in our introduction, we talked about how many times owls are seen as wise and insightful, and in fact our local library has one as its logo, an owl, right? The wise owl has to be wearing glasses. I don't know why, but talk about how some cultures view owls as that wise and insightful and intelligent, but there are maybe some other societies that think that it's a bad omen or maybe even evil in a sense.
Yes, it's really true. You know, owls are really vibrant players in stories from cultures from nearly every continent on the globe, and attitudes toward them vary tremendously. One survey, I think it was 26 countries that the scientists looked at, and about a dozen had a really positive view of owls. You know, eight were kind of neutral, and then nine had a very negative view. There's some cultures, and I think particularly of the Ainu people of northern Japan, who really revere owls, particularly the black-eastern fish owl that lives in their villages, and they consider owls protectors. Other cultures view owls really as you said, as emblems of evil, as kind of bad omens that are linked with death. And comes to mind is in Belize, you know, owls are viewed as bearers of bad luck. So if an owl comes to your house, it means that someone in the house is going to get sick or die. And that view of owls, or some kind of slight variations of it, is really a very prevalent perspective in many countries, Zambia, Kenya, Nepal, even in places in Italy.
Is it because of their different, they are dramatically different by species, right? The size of owls are dramatically different.
Their visuals,
their
behavior.
Is it because of how they appear in a different part of the world?
Yeah, so I think that it's a combination of those things. You know, if you think about, say, a bird like a barn owl, you know, it's kind of this ghostly white color. And it has these really strange night cries and a kind of habit of haunting vacant buildings. Mm. And you can sort of understand why it would give rise to the notion of a bird-like incarnation of a demon or a spirit being or something. The other reason, I think, is that we humans basically have a kind of circadian rhythm. And cardiac events like stroke, heart attack, sudden cardiac death, they most often occur in the final hours of the night. And that's also when, you know, you're likely to hear an owl calling especially in rural areas, you know, where people die at home and there, you know, there aren't hospitals, people are much more likely to bump into an owl sitting on a roof or hear one calling in the dark when they're having this kind of health crisis. So I think there's a link there.
Several nights ago, I heard an owl middle of the night, and it was a call that I was not familiar with. Owl, I figured it was some type of owl, so I took out my handy Merlin app, my bird identifier, and it turned out to be a great horned owl, which I had never heard before its call. And it was literally, Claire, the next day that you emailed me to let me know that Jennifer was going to be on the show.
Yeah.
So, Omen.
Now, this is very funny because this morning, first time ever, I've lived in this house for 32 years, I heard a great horned owl calling this morning.
No, and
it was in the yard. It was loud enough for me to hear it through the window. And I opened the window and I'm going, oh my gosh, this is just too amazing. Because I've been doing other things than owls, but today was the day that I got to talk to you all, and I thought, okay, this is a visitor.
Now that is a little creepy.
I believe a good omen. Owls to me, I think are good omens.
No, it was a interesting call, kind of. I don't know, Jennifer, you can describe it better. It sounded like a not a hoot, obviously,
please do it,
but
please.
No, it was more of a squawk variation or so.
So mine was the kind of classic. It goes
mine was more
of a hoot.
Okay, because mine was more of a squawk, and the Merlin said it was great horned. Maybe something different. But in any case, we have a few more minutes. Real quick, I know. Me too. We talk owls are apex predators. Do they have any predators themselves?
Decide for us.
Well, they certainly do when they're chicks and they're in the egg form. All kinds of predators will take baby owls and chicks and eggs.
Right.
And the little owls, the owls vary in size tremendously. So the Black Eastern's fish owl is the biggest owl in the world. It's about the size of a fire hydrant. And then you get all the way down to the elf owl, which is the smallest, and that's just like the size of a little pine cone. Mm-hmm. So the little owls are often eaten by bigger owls and also by other large birds of prey. So they're really very vulnerable. The big owls, once they get to be adults, Eurasian eagle owls, great horned owls, they don't really have any major predators.
Right.
Well, there is quite a disturbance also to their habitat. And, we can find owls just about anywhere in urban areas or rural areas. What are you in your research seeing as far as habitat loss?
Yes, it's a huge problem. I think especially of owls that depend on old growth forests. Many owls nest in the hollows of old growth trees, and those big old trees are just, very rare now, and those old growth forests are so decimated, really. Also grasslands, owls depend heavily on grasslands as hunting grounds and also nesting areas for some owls, and the grasslands are disappearing at a great rate. So I would say habitat loss is by far the greatest threat to owls. There are other threats like the use of rat poisons and collisions with vehicles and that sort of thing, but habitat loss is the big one.
And climate change, i.e. a warming world, shifting their ecosystems?
Yes, absolutely. And climate change, like for so many bird species, there are many birds, including owls, are adapted to very particular niches. And when the climate warms and the plant and animal life of their habitat changes, they are often in real trouble.
So hopefully we can maybe read your book, learn more, and people, it takes people to care. We always talk about that on the station to make sure that we are not eradicating their habitat.
How can we as backyard birders help the owl with its, lifestyle and lifespan?
It's such a great question. What I tell people is it doesn't matter how large or small your property is, create habitat for owls. First of all, leave the snags, the dead trees that some people have on their property. Plant native species, native grasses and other plants that will draw in wildlife. You can create little pockets of habitat no matter how big your plot of land may be. Also, keep your cats indoors. Cats kill owls, and they compete for their prey. So they're really a huge threat. Don't use rodenticides to control rodents. You know, use traps instead. And the last thing I say to people is to support owl research, education, and those owl rehabilitation centers. You know, organizations that are that really are helping injured owls. And also organizations and legislations legislation that's promoting habitat conservation.
And we
really important.
We have our aviary here, Tracy Aviary, which
does
rehabilitation and has some owls there.
Yep,
if
great
people want to get involved and learn more, they can probably go down there. But how do people? Oh, you have another question.
Well, no. My last question or insight was that Jennifer, there's a fabulous picture of you. Photograph of you with is it a fish owl or maybe a Eurasian or owl or something? It is a huge owl, and it's a fantastic photo of you with this owl.
Oh, yeah, that's a great gray owl in Sweden.
Oh, my goodness. You got to go to the publisher's website and check out that photo. It's magnificent, both you and the owl.
Well,
thank you. It was wonderful to be so close to such a big, magnificent bird. It was really a high point for me.
And where can people go to? Do you have a website where they can learn more about you and your writings?
Yes, I do. Thank you for asking. It's www.jenniferackermanauthor.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. I know we could talk to you all day, Jennifer. So fascinating. Thank you so much for being on This Green Earth. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And joining us for the second part of the show is Dr. Holly Michael. She's the director of the Delaware Environmental Institute and also the professor of earth sciences and civil and environmental engineering at the University of Delaware. And she's here to talk about the phenomena of saltwater intrusion, which sounds very kind of wonky and such, but believe me, it has huge potential implications on our environment and ecosystems and our drinking water systems. Mm-hmm. Dr. Michael, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
So let's, we usually like to start with some definition of terms. So give us a definition of what saltwater intrusion is, maybe what it's not.
Sure. Saltwater intrusion is anytime freshwater becomes salinized. So typically or often it happens in coastal systems where seawater moves inland into areas that were previously fresh. But saltwater intrusion can also happen in other areas. For example, there might be deep salty brines that come up and salinize fresh groundwater. So really, saltwater intrusion is any increase in salinity of freshwater.
Okay, so we have, let's parse it out between talking about like surface water systems and then we'll turn to groundwater systems. So with respect to surface water systems, we have lots of estuaries and bays that have tidal influence. So they are at times during the course of a normal day, more fresh water and more salt water. You're saying though that salt water is slowly migrating further inland in these systems?
That's right. I like to think of freshwater and saltwater as being part of a seesaw. So there's an interface between the freshwater and saltwater, whether that's in surface water or in groundwater. And the position of that interface is going to depend on the forces coming from the land. So the freshwater coming from the land toward the sea, and also from forces from the sea. So sea level and tides and waves and storms and things like that. And so you're right that naturally, in tidal systems, that interface is going to move back and forth, right? These forces are going to change. But over time, as sea level increases, for example, that interface can slowly creep further and further inland so that areas that used to be always fresh now sometimes become salinized.
All right, so let's talk about why salt water is migrating inland, or yeah, I guess that's, for lack of a better way of describing it, migrating more and more inland. What's going on there?
Sure. So it can be a number of factors. I mean, the one we think about often is sea level rise, like mm-hmm. I mentioned, right? So slowly over time in many areas, as relative sea level is increasing, that force from the sea becomes greater. And so that freshwater saltwater interface, the saltwater, you know, slowly moves further inland. But that can also happen if there are changes, say, to rainfall patterns, or if there are droughts or things like that. Mm. So in terms of climate change, sea level rise is a major one, but there are also increases in extreme events like droughts, for example, and also like storm surges. And so both the slow creep of sea level rise and then these increases in extreme events that can push that salt further inland are causing more and more saltwater intrusion.
What kind of rise are we talking about? You're at the University of Delaware, so you're familiar with the estuary systems in the Chesapeake and the Delaware and the Atlantic coastline, I suppose. What kind of saltwater or what kind of sea level rise are we seeing there?
Yeah, so, sea level rise, the rate of sea level rise varies very much across the globe. And in the mid-Atlantic, where we are in Delaware, the rate of relative sea level rise is actually among the greatest in the world. Mm. And there are two reasons for that. One is just that the sea level is rising due to the various factors that are causing that to happen globally. But also in the mid-Atlantic, we are experiencing slow change in elevation in response to the last glaciation. So if you can imagine, when there were glaciers, the glaciers didn't come quite down to the mid-Atlantic, right? The glaciers stopped somewhere in New England. And so when the glaciers were present, they really pressed down on that land in New England, which then, again, you can kind of think of a seesaw. That pressing down in the land in the north actually caused the mid-Atlantic to rise a little bit. And then when the glaciers retreated, there was no longer that big weight in the north. And so, you can think of the land as sort of coming back to an equilibrium. And so that means that the land surface elevation in the mid-Atlantic is sinking at the same time that sea level is rising. So that relative sea level is increasing pretty rapidly.
When you're testing these seawater intrusions, what is that process of collecting that data? How do you collect that? And what are those study periods that you're collecting that data?
Sure. So we study saltwater intrusion both into groundwater and to surface water. So in terms of the surface, one thing we're really interested in is ecological change. So how saltwater intrusion is, slowly creeping inland and changing the freshwater ecosystems. So for example, we instrumented many sites around the mid-Atlantic along transects going from salt marsh to healthy ecosystems inland. And in particular, we're interested in forests and agriculture. And so we have lots of instrumentation. We're measuring water levels, salinity. We're also measuring the land surface elevation very carefully. We're interested in the biogeochemical processes that are happening. So for example, is that saltwater encroachment changing the carbon cycle, or is it releasing nutrients? Mm. And we are also monitoring ecological change. So doing ecological surveys, counting healthy and dead trees, for example. We also do measurements like sap flux, so we can actually monitor water going up the trees and understand how salt might affect that. So that's one example of how we monitor saltwater intrusion. In the subsurface, it's a little bit more difficult. And so with groundwater, we typically drill wells and, you know, again, along gradients from where we know the saltwater exists underground to where it's fresher. And then we monitor how that salt moves over time.
And when were you starting these studies? And so you're basing against this timeline. What's that timeline of that increase?
Yeah, so so it's hard to monitor for really slow change when, you know, typically our science projects are maybe 5 years, sometimes a little bit longer. But so Our transect studies we designed to be spaced for time, right? So in a system that's changing slowly, you can think of a transect from the marsh to the healthy forest as not only representing a spatial gradient, but also a time gradient. So at some point, if sea level keeps rising, then what is now, say, a healthy forest will look more like what's in the transition zone. And so we can think about, you know, understanding what freshwater ecosystems might look like in the future as, you know, what the transitional ecosystems look like now. Mm. But it turns out that the systems that we're studying are changing so rapidly that we're actually seeing these changes in real time. So our healthy forests in several of our sites have actually started to die off. And that means we've had to actually add another site to our transect to keep it in the healthy. So even over a 5-year time scale, we are seeing change. That's how rapidly it's happening.
Wow, let's talk a little bit more about that. What kinds of changes in first salinity are we talking about? We know that small changes in water chemistry can have large impacts on ecosystems. I think of pH. Small changes in pH can have large dramatic impacts on coral systems. Is it similar to that with small changes in concentrations of salinity?
That's right, yeah, and it depends a lot on the species that you're talking about,
right.
But it doesn't take much salt to stress vegetation, right? And so some vegetation is quite resilient. So trees, for example, you know, maybe there's a storm every so often and that causes salinization, but then you get rain and it flushes out and the tree might be stressed for some period of time, but then it recovers. And the same is true for, you know, for other vegetation. In terms of crops, well, you know, a crop might be ruined for 1 year if it gets, you know, if there's a big saltwater flooding event, but then the next year, you know, that salt may have flushed out and it may be fine. But what really causes change is these repetitive events. So, you know, as storms become more frequent, they become more intense, that means that these periods of stress are going to also become more frequent and intense. And so at some point, there's a tipping point where the vegetation just can't take any more stress, and that's when you see changes.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Holly Michael. She's a professor of earth sciences and civil and environmental engineering at the University of Delaware, and also the director at the Delaware Environmental Institute. Dr. Michael, I'm an environmental engineer, and I spent a lot of years working down in Florida, and some of them working in the Everglades. And the first time I became aware of saltwater intrusion was with respect to actually mangrove swamps. I figured, well, mangroves, they're saltwater species. They can handle a little increased salinity. No, that's not the case. They are very sensitive to small changes. And then, like any system like that, if the mangroves go, the cascading effect on the ecosystem with respect to other fish or aquatic animals and birds and insects, there is a knock-on effect. Whether it's mangroves or other grass-based saltwater estuaries.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's not just vegetation change. The whole ecosystem changes,
right.
And the balance of that ecosystem changes. And so There's a cascading effect, as you say, both in the vegetation, but also in other aspects of the system. The system is fully connected. So that means that it's the vegetation, it's the biota, it's the biogeochemistry. That means the microbes are affected, right? So the whole functioning of the system is really changing. And so that affects all kinds of cycles. It affects the water cycle, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's being done? What are some of the solutions to this? What are we coming up with? I shouldn't say we. What are you coming up with?
How can we address this? Either engineer our way out of this condition or problem, let's say.
Sure. I mean, there, of course, are engineering solutions. If a farmer wants to protect their field, there are things that they can do in terms of, you know, putting up berms. And we, of course, have levees and things like that that are engineering solutions. But in the end, you know, nature tends to win out. So even if you protect the land from surface water encroachment, from storms, the saltwater intrusion is still happening underground. And mm-hmm. So, you know, it can seep underground into our irrigation wells, for example, and of course our drinking water wells. So there are some engineering solutions, but, you know, they're not always effective. So, and, you know, the other thing is that, you know, allowing nature to take its course is not necessarily a bad thing. Hmm. So our marshes are critical ecosystems. They sequester more carbon per square meter than forests. Hmm. And so, you know, if marshes are migrating into forests, yeah, we see ghost forests. We see these dead trees mm-hmm. that, you know, look like something very terrible is happening. But at the same time, the marsh ecosystems are important. And as sea level rises, we're losing marsh on the seaward end, right? So those marshes tend to be drowning and shrinking. So allowing them to move inland is actually maintaining their area. And that means that all that carbon they're sequestering, you know, can continue to be sequestered. And so, you know, one thing we're interested in understanding is the potential to allow marshes to migrate into forests, but also into farmland, into managed land. One, because of the ecosystem services that it provides in terms of carbon storage, et cetera, but also because marshes protect the land behind it from storms, from flooding. And so, you know, it's possible that allowing marshes to migrate, you know, a little bit into farm fields or into your lawn can actually protect what's behind it. So, you know, I think every system is different. Every case is different. There may be clear engineering solutions in some cases, but also in others, it may be better to allow things to change.
One engineering solution is to inject treated wastewater mm-hmm. into the groundwater as a way of creating a barrier. Mm-hmm. It has to be highly treated wastewater, almost near, you know, fresh water, basically, as a potential barrier. I'm seeing more communities when I was living in Florida, they were doing this. It seemed to work. Of course, it's a very expensive proposition. Is that, has your research shown that that's an option?
Yes, absolutely. You're right. They do that a lot in Florida. We have a little bit of land-based wastewater application in Delaware as well and in many other places. And it is an important engineering solution for the groundwater saltwater intrusion, because again, you know, thinking about that seesaw, if you're injecting fresh water underground, that's going to push that saltwater back. Mm-hmm. And so that is a really important, you know, potential technology or engineering solution for protecting fresh drinking water resources in particular.
And that's my question, is when you get to the drinking water, even a small amount can make a difference mm-hmm. to how your system processes it, and it's not super great on the kidneys.
Well, yeah, you want to keep the salt as best possible out of that
right.
drinking water, that raw water, because mm-hmm. like you say, it more as salt water intrudes in the groundwater or into the wells, pulling up the water for the drinking water system, more salt in that water requires more treatment.
Effects, yeah.
More treatment requires more cost, and it can be labor and maintenance intensive. So yeah, there's a lot of challenges. Not one thing we didn't mention, Dr. Michael, is that consumption of fresh water or groundwater also can invite migration of salt water inland.
That's right, yeah. In fact, that's probably the most common mechanism for saltwater intrusion into groundwater is just overuse. That's in terms of water management in coastal areas, that's a critical component is making sure that we use our fresh groundwater in an intelligent way and make sure that we're monitoring and we understand the system so that we can prevent the saltwater intrusion, because once the wells become salty, really it's very hard to remediate them to be able to use them. And so typically, wells that become salinized are just abandoned. They move wells further inland. And also in terms of, we talked about treatment, just a little bit of salt into a treatment process can really cause problems because, right. Water treatment is a very careful, chemical system. And so if you add salt, you can cause disinfection byproducts that are actually really harmful to health and things like that. And so, salt wreaks all kinds of havoc on drinking water.
Well, we got to wrap up. Where can people go to learn more about your research with respect to this issue and, other saltwater intrusion? We don't have that big of a problem here in Utah.
And we just put in a big water treatment plant.
Although we have a huge, salty, extremely salty lake. We have a different set of issues here. But where can people go to learn more about your work?
Sure. So you mentioned I direct the Delaware Environmental Institute. That's Denin, D-E-N-I-N. So you can go to our website. And one of the projects I mentioned is an NSF-funded Coastal Critical Zone Network, so Coastal CZN. We also have a website that you can learn about our research there.
All right, Dr. Holly Michael, Professor of Earth Sciences and Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Delaware. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thank you for helping us break that down into ways that we can understand.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.